This book is an attempt to start a conversation that needs to happen, especially but not only in America. A conversation about the end of American empire and what will come after it. In order to make sense of the impact that the fall of America's empire is going to have on all our lives in the decades ahead, it is crucial to understand what empires are, what makes them tick, and what makes them collapse. To do that, however, it will be necessary to bundle up an assortment of unhelpful assumptions and misunderstandings of history and chuck them into the compost. We can start with the verbal habit of using empire, or more exactly, the capitalized abstraction empire, as what S.I. Hayakawa used to call a snarl word, a content-free verbal noise that's used to express feelings of hatred. The language of politics these days consists largely of snarl words. When people on the leftward end of the political spectrum say fascist or empire, for example, more often than not, these words mean exactly what socialist or liberal people mean to people on the right. That is, they express the emotional state of the speaker rather than anything relevant about the object under discussion. Behind this common habit is one of the most disturbing trends in contemporary political life. Setting aside ordinary disagreement in favor of seething rage against a demonized other on whom all the world's problems can conveniently be blamed. The need to sidestep this habit makes it urgent to get past the currently popular custom of using terms like empire as snarl words and recover their actual meaning as descriptions of specific forms of human, political, economic, and social interaction. Getting rid of that initial capital letter, arbitrary as it seems, is one step in the right direction. The younger President Bush's administration was able to disguise a stack of dubious motives and justify a misguided rush to war by converting the tangled reality of Muslim resentment and radical militancy into the capitalized abstraction of terror. In a similar fashion, many people on the other side of the political spectrum have covered equally dubious motives and justified equally unproductive actions by converting the tangled realities of influence, authority, and privilege in modern industrial states into the capitalized abstraction of empire. The so-called global war on terror, of course, turned out to be an expensive flop, and much of what passes for fighting empire, though a good deal less costly in blood and money, has been no more productive. In this book, then, I will be discussing empires, not capital empire. And as soon as some initial questions of definition are taken care of, I will be discussing specific empires, the one the United States currently maintains, primarily, but also the British Empire that preceded it, and several others that cast useful light on the American Empire's past, present, and future. One striking detail, of course, sets today's American empire apart from most of its predecessors. The curious fact that the only people these days willing to admit in public that the United States has an empire are almost always those who denounce it. That's a very rare thing in the history of empires. As recently as the late 19th century, the world's empires proudly claimed that title, and those who argued that the United States should hurry up and get an empire of its own saw no need to cover that ambition with euphemisms. The popular rhetoric of that era celebrated the huge European empires of the day, especially that of Britain, which covered a quarter of the planet's land surface and had effective control over all its oceans, and insisted that since imperial rule brought peace and the benefits of European civilization to the rest of the world, it was a good thing for all concerned. The same case has been made in recent years by a handful of conservative intellectuals, notably the historian Niall Ferguson, and a certain number of facts can be cited in its support. Periods when one imperial power dominates any given system of nations tend to be periods of relative peace and stability, while periods that lack such a centralized power tend to be racked by wars and turmoil. Imperial Britain's century of world dominion from 1815 to 1914, for example, featured fewer wars, in Europe at least, than any comparable period up to that time. And American dominion since 1945 has imposed an even more rigid peace on that fractious continent. Outside Europe, to be sure, the imperial rule of Britain was a good deal less peaceful, and that of the United States has not been much better. This book is an attempt to start a conversation that needs to happen, especially but not only in America, a conversation about the end of American empire and what will come after it. In order to make sense of the impact that the fall of America's empire is going to have on all our lives in the decades ahead, it is crucial to understand what empires are, what makes them tick, and what makes them collapse. To do that, however, it will be necessary to bundle up an assortment of unhelpful assumptions and misunderstandings of history and chuck them into the compost. We can start with the verbal habit of using empire, or more exactly, the capitalized abstraction empire, as what S.I. Hayakawa used to call a snarl word, a content-free verbal noise that's used to express feelings of hatred. The language of politics these days consists largely of snarl words. When people on the leftward end of the political spectrum say fascist or empire, for example, more often than not, these words mean exactly what socialist or liberal people mean to people on the right. That is, they express the emotional state of the speaker rather than anything relevant about the object under discussion. Behind this common habit is one of the most disturbing trends in contemporary political life. Setting aside ordinary disagreement in favor of seething rage against a demonized other on whom all the world's problems can conveniently be blamed. The need to sidestep this habit makes it urgent to get past the currently popular custom of using terms like empire as snarl words and recover their actual meaning as descriptions of specific forms of human, political, economic, and social interaction. Getting rid of that initial capital letter, arbitrary as it seems, is one step in the right direction. The younger President Bush's administration was able to disguise a stack of dubious motives and justify a misguided rush to war by converting the tangled reality of Muslim resentment and radical militancy into the capitalized abstraction of terror. In a similar fashion, many people on the other side of the political spectrum have covered equally dubious motives and justified equally unproductive actions by converting the tangled realities of influence, authority, and privilege in modern industrial states into the capitalized abstraction of empire. The so-called global war on terror, of course, turned out to be an expensive flop, and much of what passes for fighting empire, though a good deal less costly in blood and money, has been no more productive. In this book, then, I will be discussing empires, not capital empire. And as soon as some initial questions of definition are taken care of, I will be discussing specific empires, the one the United States currently maintains, primarily, but also the British Empire that preceded it, and several others that cast useful light on the American Empire's past, present, and future. One striking detail, of course, sets today's American empire apart from most of its predecessors. The curious fact that the only people these days willing to admit in public that the United States has an empire are almost always those who denounce it. That's a very rare thing in the history of empires, As recently as the late 19th century, the world's empires proudly claimed that title, and those who argued that the United States should hurry up and get an empire of its own saw no need to cover that ambition with euphemisms. The popular rhetoric of that era celebrated the huge European empires of the day, especially that of Britain, which covered a quarter of the planet's land surface and had effective control over all its oceans, and insisted that since imperial rule brought peace and the benefits of European civilization to the rest of the world, it was a good thing for all concerned. The same case has been made in recent years by a handful of conservative intellectuals, notably the historian Niall Ferguson, and a certain number of facts can be cited in its support. Periods when one imperial power dominates any given system of nations tend to be periods of relative peace and stability, while periods that lack such a centralized power tend to be racked by wars and turmoil. Imperial Britain's century of world dominion from 1815 to 1914, for example, featured fewer wars, in Europe at least, than any comparable period up to that time. And American dominion since 1945 has imposed an even more rigid peace on that fractious continent. Outside Europe, to be sure, the imperial rule of Britain was a good deal less peaceful, and that of the United States has not been much better.